sustainability in the metropolitan New York region, which is an area that already has air quality issues that are impacting people's health, obviously. And climate change is a subject of great concern to the research community, to the community of people there. So there's been incredible opportunities to look today and to look ahead, and estimated 7% of the population of the United States live in this region, so we're concerned already about the health effects today that air pollution presents to people. But we're interested also, I have nothing to declare or disclose except what I'm going to tell you now about this issue, but nothing financial to disclose. So we've had the opportunity to talk about this issue of climate change and it bears how it bears on air pollution. I want to mention that everything that Sharon and Mary and Christine have touched upon also has impacts on the New York metropolitan region, which I think of as a tri-state region encompassing parts of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. We think of it in my work as now 21 million plus people, many more people in future. It has trillions of dollars of insured coastline, trillions of dollars. Infectious diseases very much impact the population of the region today. Hundreds of people have had West Nile infections and dozens of people have perished since 1999. That's where West Nile, you know, came to North America. Heat waves very much affect the population of New York City and caused illness and death. And indeed, that's probably been sort of the flashpoint of a lot of the work that has now turned into adaptation and preparedness opportunities, and I'll talk about that later. And certainly, forest fires, I'll touch on that later, are not something that are solely a Western United States phenomenon. But I want to talk about air pollution and climate change because there's so much population density, transportation, industry, and it's a regional you know, air pollution effect that so much has affected the millions of people living in the region. And let me give you a little bit of background on how climate change affects all of this. Of course, climate change will cause temperatures to rise. There's been projections that by the end of the century, there could be 8 degrees Fahrenheit rise in temperatures in the region. This last summer, we had record-breaking temperatures in the region, including higher nighttime temperatures. The lack of the conference of that nighttime cooling benefit can be especially harmful to health. Those rising temperatures increase ground-level ozone smog, and I'll talk about that in more detail later on in the talk. Climate change, rising temperatures in the atmosphere change rainfall patterns. Higher CO2 concentrations can change production of aeroallergens. Increasing wildfire risks, I'll touch on that. Furthermore, there's synergies between these different air pollution sources that can very much affect people's health. Something else is that the people that are exposed anywhere, but I'm talking about our New York regional population, the vulnerable communities vary across the region. There's these three dimensions of pollution vulnerability and climate change vulnerability. There's exposures, which vary across any region. There's susceptibilities, underlying medical conditions, other sort of aspects, dimensions of susceptibility that in this panel and in others that we've heard already at the conference figure into susceptibility, pre-existing medical conditions, demographic factors like age, built environment factors, and preparedness. One example, the availability of air conditioning varies widely across the metropolitan region. There's some estimates that 83% of households in the region have the benefit of air conditioning, but that varies by neighborhood incredibly, you know, between one neighborhood in northern Manhattan versus in central Harlem versus in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So that means exposures and the ability to adapt to rising temperatures is going to vary. And that doesn't mean that air conditioning is, you know, the absolute end-all and be-all of adaptation strategies. But all these three dimensions have to figure into the ongoing conversation about what does adaptation and preparedness mean. So these, again, are part of the set of factors that go into those three dimensions. Some of the factors that go into these increasing exposures as climate change continues to affect the region. And again, increasing susceptibility. Some of the populations that as the panel and others have said, are really susceptible to climate change, in rising temperatures, and air pollution in this case, our children, who are more active outside, who exercise more, who have a more rapid breathing rate when they exercise, the elderly, who have a greater tendency to pre-existing respiratory cardiovascular illnesses. Increased exposure, often in communities of color, people living in poverty. Today in America, we have the highest rates of poverty across the population since the 1950s. So these are ongoing social issues that again compound where we're at with climate change and with our air pollution problem that we've had in the New York metro region for years. We're an ozone non-compliance region. It's been estimated that we're the 9th most ozone smog polluted metro region in the U.S. And as Christine mentioned, ozone is a secondary pollutant. It's not, you know, emitted from tailpipes from smokestacks. It's formed in the atmosphere from photochemical reactions of volatile organic compounds, mainly hydrocarbons that come out of, you know, vehicle emissions from industry, from utilities, and nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere. This last summer, with that heat that we experienced in New York's metro region, we had 5 times the normal number of air alert days, of those days when that are considered unhealthy to human health, because of that temperature dependence of the ozone formation chemistry. That is very concerning for human health. These are just some maps from the EPA website that not only in terms of ozone compliance, but particulate matter, PM, the New York region is a longstanding ozone non-compliance region. There have definitely been improvements in air quality since the institution of the Clean Air Act, but there are still hot spots, local areas in which, and I'll show you some more about this because we've got some it's really great new work that's happening in the New York metro region, but it's generally a non-compliance region. Air pollution has really devastating effects on human health, and I want to call out ozone smog. This is ground level ozone smog, particulate matter, and some of the synergies of those two combined that harm human health. Ozone smog is a really powerful lung irritant, asthma exacerbation, wheeze, lung irritation can cause cough, even in the healthy among us, athletes, but for kids, for adults with asthma. New York City has one of the highest asthma rates in the country. It's been linked to premature death, as has particulate matter. There's a lot, an enormous body of literature on this, and some of the exposure sources that have been mentioned already, wildfires, Christine's work, but also mobile sources from vehicles, and I'll talk a little bit about even boilers that provide energy for buildings in the New York region can really be a significant source of particulate matter in the region. But I want to talk a little bit about something that's perhaps a little more subtle that until recently we haven't thought about so much, which are aeroallergens, plants that are, everywhere, very, pedestrian found, not just out in the countryside, but this what's pictured is ragweed, which it's been estimated is the plant to which more people are allergic than all other plants combined. And with higher CO2 concentrations, ragweed produces more pollen over a longer period, earlier in the spring and longer into the fall season, perhaps in greater concentration. And there's been some studies that suggest that the allergenicity, that the allergic response in those individuals who are responsive to ragweed pollen is more intense. So there's all kinds of dimensions of a more potentially harmful health effect in response to rising CO2 concentrations. These numbers are coming from laboratory-based studies of the response of ragweed pollen to carbon dioxide. But there's also been sort of field studies that are showing that there's higher ragweed pollen production in the field in response to higher carbon dioxide concentrations. There's a concern of ours that two things. Ragweed in particular, because its pollen is produced late in the summer, and that's typically when ground level ozone smog is at its highest too, because that's when temperatures are highest. That's the double whammy that we're talking about in terms of ragweed pollen and ozone concentrations that are of real concern to the hundreds of thousands of adults and children in the New York metro region that have allergies and asthma. NRDC in 2007 did a mapping study where we looked at counties in the US where ragweed occurs, and there are also summertime ozone exceedance days, unhealthy ozone days. And the sort of upshot of this map is there are 308 counties in the US, 110 million Americans live in counties where both of those occur at the same time. And I've highlighted the New York metro region in blue. I can give anyone who's interested the link to this larger study because it's got more information about it, what that means in terms of health. But we're concerned about this synergizing of these air pollution threats. Again, New York City, back to susceptibilities, there are differential susceptibilities around the and across the different neighborhoods of New York City. And I'm highlighting just some of those in terms of African Americans in particular, but the Hispanic population also of New York City's, both adults and children, are among the highest in terms of asthma hospitalizations, not just in New York either, but in the United States as a whole, have a much higher rate of asthma hospitalization as opposed to sort of the at-large population. But in terms of looking, as this map does, a little bit closer at the neighborhoods of New York City, I wanted to highlight some recent work that's being done by the New York City Department of Health, the acronym there, the Mayor's Office, and Queens College have begun to conduct the New York City Community Air Survey, which really holds a lot of promise and a lot of potential for taking a closer look at what's happening at the street level. This is placing, since 2008 when it got going, 150 street level air monitoring stations around the five boroughs to look at PM2.5, fine particles, elemental carbon, nitrogen oxide, NO2, ozone, around the five boroughs at different times of the year. They do a winter and summer survey. They're an incredible source of information. I've put the URL for the winter and summer reports that are already out as a way of understanding what are the finer grained exposures around the city of New York and where are these differential exposures and how, sort of next iteration, might that link to those differential susceptibilities. And I just want to highlight a couple of things that are beginning to come out of this work, which holds so much promise. In the summertime, this is a map coming out of the summer part of that survey. It's really the PM2.5, which has so much damage to health, human health. It's really a traffic and population density association. This map is showing that here's lower Manhattan. This is Manhattan borough of New York City, where traffic is really incredibly dense. So really, this points to the need for, in terms of health today and moving forward into the future, let's look towards green transportation, towards enhancing bike, walking, better green infrastructure. It makes sense for health today in terms of these are all combustion sources that have greenhouse gas emissions too. It makes sense in terms of climate and health adaptation in future too. In wintertime, different story. It's building-related heating emissions that are the source, one of the major sources of particulate matter in New York City in the wintertime. And there's moves in New York City to create regulations that will shift from the dirtier fuels, home heating fuels, in the bigger rental buildings of Manhattan and the bigger sort of multi-unit buildings of Manhattan, shift away from high sulfur, dirty fuels toward cleaner fuels that emit less PM2.5. And that could be really, really confer an enormous benefit to health and to air quality. Here's a map of ozone and showing just that. Another, I think, important dimension of this, it's not just an urban story. This is showing that ozone concentrations are not just highest in the urban core, but in Staten Island and in areas downwind are some of the highest ozone smog concentrations in summer. So this is really a story that affects the whole region of the metropolitan New York. Looking ahead, this is not just a tale of today. I was involved in the New York Climate and Health Project that really tried to ask the question, what is climate change going to do to human health in future? So public health people collaborated with regional climate modelers, with atmospheric chemists to ask that question. and do modeling across the New York metropolitan region in gray there on the right, and do model simulations of ozone concentrations in future under a changing climate. How are rising temperatures going to impact ozone concentrations? The results showed that by the 2020s, there could be an increase in the region of between 12 to 35 parts per billion. That's additional ozone just from that rising temperature, that sets of rising temperatures. So the map on the right is showing with the redder colors suggesting higher ozone concentrations relative to the 1990s. You can see that the New York metro region is within that larger east of Mississippi model area. Looking just at the metro region, this is at the county level. Again, it's not just a story of urban health impacts. There was, across the whole region, a median 4.5% increase in summer ozone-related mortality, but look at the sort of differential changes in ozone-related mortality. This is a paper that was in Environmental Health Perspectives in 2004. There really need to be more of these regionally, locally downscaled ozone studies. I mean, this needs to happen so that more regions can get the story of what's going to happen to us locally under a changing climate. To us, it seems like there's four basic elements or dimensions of these preparedness strategies in future. Identifying local vulnerabilities. Where are the most vulnerable people in terms, communities, in terms of those three dimensions, exposure, susceptibility, and preparedness? Where do they live, and what are the kind of exposures that projects like New York Community Air study could tell us about what the exposures could be in future. Secondly, tracking the health threats as they arise. One thing that's starting to happen now is that there's a project in New York City where people can get alerts on their cell phones on days that are high ozone, and you can have it sent right to your cell phone. Of course, there's always like online or sites that people can go to find daily pollen and ozone high ozone days. That's always been available through EPA AirNow site, but it's great that people can have it sent right to the individual user. There's also local, in terms of building more resilient communities, again, there's increasingly laws and regulations locally that are reducing idling times around schools so that people cannot idle more than 1 minute, or it's enforceable by fines, by laws. That's to improve air quality around schools so kids are not getting dosed by particulate matter, by diesel particles, and that has, you know, a greenhouse gas emission benefit down the road too, but that's got to be enforced. There's got to be, you know, really rigorous enforcement of these laws that are coming on the books that are really designed to protect kids' health. But it really does have sort of a very much a climate change down the road mindset in mind too. Promoting the public dialogue, there continues to be a listenership of people who are very engaged on climate change, from the research community to community groups like WEACT, like UPROSE, the community groups who know full well and are already experiencing the impacts of climate change, who really need to continue to be informed and involved in the dialogue that's happening, because in New York State and New York City, we are now benefiting from some incredible climate health preparedness projects that are coming our way. Like, both New York City and New York State are part of CDC's Climate Ready States and Cities initiative. Look, in New York City, they have been the recipients of one of those the grants that have just been awarded that will build capacity to implement more climate health adaptation. Plan NYC, which is through the mayor's office, has already made a commitment to cut global warming pollution and co-pollutants, of course, 30% by the year 2030. New York City has a panel on climate change that has created New York City-specific simulations of climate change into the future, sort of the counterpart to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but for New York City. And again, the community organizations that are so engaged on this issue, like WEACT's last year in January 2009, the summit on climate justice that they ran and in New York City was like a groundbreaking conference that brought together knowledge on the issue of climate justice and what needs to be done to move forward on this issue. Preparedness, what really you know, needs to be done so that we can not only get projects going, but evaluate them in future and come back and improve them. At the state level in New York, again, we have this incredible opportunity through another CDC Climate Ready States and Cities initiative to do assessment and planning to get those projects going. New York State also has a ClimAid adaptation assessment project with a public health chapter in it, has a New York State Climate Action Plan and an Action Council. And across the state, there's city-level initiatives, county-level initiatives to get preparedness plans going that are about health. So we know some of the things that we need to prepare for. Air pollution-related mortality increases. We are aware that aeroallergens are already challenging kids and adults' health. We know that we need to beef up and green up our transportation planning. We want to create cities that are more livable, more walkable, more bikeable. We want to do what we can to diminish the health disparities that already are making our air pollution problems worse, because climate change is just going to exacerbate what we're already experiencing. But there's the surprises, the wildfires that now seem like a Western state's problem. But here's an image of wildfires in Canada, the emissions from which affected very much the northeastern states. Wildfire emissions, as you pointed out, Christine, can travel hundreds of kilometers and affect air quality and human health, hundreds of kilometers downwind. So we really need to be nimble enough that we can move and prepare for the unexpected health consequence in future. So we really want to now get on with the dialogue about where do we go from here? How can we keep the small-scale studies like the New York City Community Air Survey going, but how can we engage community knowledge and expertise and get everyone at the table? So we're now talking about vulnerability and resilience and get that conversation going so that the next time that we get together and talk about expertise and steps, that we're sort of changing this equation so that we're not thinking that vulnerability is winning the day, but perhaps preparedness in a year or two or 10 will be winning the day, and we'll be more talking about refining our assessment and surveillance and, you know, smart design and education. We will get there. It's just a matter of now dialoguing and making our plans so that we can refine our own planning. So with that, I want to thank my co-authors, co-organizers, who couldn't join us today, Miriam Rotkin-Ellman and Gina Solomon, and the panelists here, Patrick Kinney, who was the one of the co-PIs on the New York Climate and Health Project, which was a project that I was lucky enough to be on for my doctoral work, people, Cindy and Alan Horton, who support the global warming and health work at NRDC, all of you for being here, the fantastic panel, all of you. But I really want to now open up the discussion to Q&As about climate health vulnerability and where we go from here. So thank you very much. So with that, we have 15 minutes for discussion, and we have a question or two that we had sort of framed for ourselves, but I think I want to go first out to you, like I see two hands for starters, and then we'll come back to our thoughts. So, Dr. Balbus, and then another hand here. Why don't you start?
First of all, those were fabulous presentations. Great work.
Thank you.
I had a question for Dr. Wiedemeyer. Very impressive figures there, the quantity of the emissions. And obviously, there's two sides to what we need to do. One is a public health intervention and addressing fires that are happening. But I'm thinking about the modeling side and the importance of modeling and the assessment side. And in the kind of modeling that you're doing, those emission factors are really, really critical in driving the numbers. A lot of you can do an uncertainty analysis, it's all going to hone in on those emission factors.
Actually, I think those are the most are certain out of the whole emission modeling.
Well, that was my question. So that was the question I had was, first of all, you know, from your lab work, is there much variation on a seasonal basis, on a spatial basis in those emission factors? And the second question is, what do we know about the impact of weather variability on the emission factors themselves? Would a 5-year drought change the emission factors compared to a 1-year drought? There's people looking at that in my question.
Yeah, that's excellent. I didn't touch on uncertainty very much in my whole talk, but modeling emissions from fires, of course, it's extremely, extremely difficult. And you just brought up a really important point about these emission factors. We use a lot of, we parameterize the models to a large extent. And the emission factors come from a lot of different experiments. I think they've advanced incredibly in the last 10 years. There's a paper about to come out just in the next month that has kind of a revised compilation of all the studies that have gone on around the world right now that are going to revisit all the emission factors. But yes, if you have a flaming versus a smoldering fire, you have different emissions. If you have an extremely drought condition, you have different emissions than you would if the fuel was wet. And so you do have to take into all of these considerations. But my right now, the uncertainties in estimating emissions are so large, and I think that you know the uncertainties just in the emission factors is just one component to the whole story. And I take a more simplistic approach because I'm at this point not convinced that adding more details really getting you that much further. So, but that's why there's several groups out there working on estimates, and we all use different methods. And actually, there's been a large push to kind of come together and look at the range of potentials using all these different methods instead of just saying that this is it.
You had a question?
Yes, actually it's for Dr. Harlan and Hayden, Drs. Harlan and Hayden. You talked about scale, and I think that's a really critical issue for those of us in health because we've got these small scale vulnerabilities that are exhibited on a neighborhood level. We're looking at relatively uncommon health outcomes. How can we reconcile that? I noticed that you were taking a different approach, Dr. Harlan, to looking at death certificates and identifying heat-related morbidities. I just would be interested in how you suggest we address it. I've got a West Nile project and a climate change project, and trying to find health outcome data for our modeling is our challenge.
So it's a question about finding data?
Yeah, more actually, data that is robust on a small area scale, so essentially spatial matching.
Right. So one of the problems with the death certificate data is that there are no numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have in my project a partnership with the Center for Health Information and Research at Arizona State, and they have created a database of hospitalizations and emergency department visits for the whole county. And what we're in the process of doing now is getting permission to geocode the deaths that are related to these categories mm-hmm. that the epidemiologist has outlined. So this is, as far as I'm aware, the first attempt to try to actually look at the larger numbers of hospitalizations and geocode them. And we'll see. We're hopeful that that's going to, you know, strengthen our conclusions and findings mm-hmm. about where things are occurring.
So you're able to geocode to home address rather than hospital?
We will, yes, it won't be hospital. It will be to, well, not to their exact residence. We won't be given that information, but it will be to the centroid of the census block group where they reside.
And then for dealing with dengue, with even smaller numbers.
Right. And so typically what we've done with dengue, and also actually we had a pilot project in Phoenix where we experimented with looking at a very local scale, at a neighborhood level scale, and then are trying to use data mining techniques to scale up from that. So that's another approach to this as well.
Yes, do you have a question?
And I don't know if you can answer my question here. I'm going to fumble because this whole climate change conversation is very challenging for me. I will say that up front. I'm working with a group in Detroit, Michigan. We are looking at the impacts of extreme storms, intense rainstorms, in a neighborhood. We're actually trying to create a neighborhood demonstration model to look at combined sewer overflows and the impacts around that and what sort of adaptive climate change adaptive measures that we can put in place that would help us to deal with these issues. But we struggle around having a community conversation. I mean, we can look at the data, we try to interpret the data from the standpoint of how to make it relevant to health and what people are experiencing in the community. How do you do that? How do you have a basic community conversation around health, climate change and what area of interest you're focusing on. Like I said, we're looking at extreme storms and combined sewer overflow. How do you have that kind of conversation? And you can say, I don't know.
Anyone can take a stab at that. What occurs to me is to look for a template of putting that conversation together. Like the first thing that occurs to me is, have you gotten everyone around the table who in the community who's exposed right now to the health threats of when there is an extreme storm event and there's a sewer overflow and like what your health challenges are now?
We do have that, but they don't understand. I shouldn't say that. We don't understand how to translate that from a climate change angle.
Mm-hmm. So what occurs to me is to try and figure out who are the partners to get around the table for like a kickoff conversation, and to first of all get the people together to formulate that and talk about process and map out like what the process will be going forward, like how to get to where you want to be, and talk about that before you get out there and start doing it, and figure out if there's a template for how, if anyone else has done that in another community, and see to what extent you can model yourself after that. Let's talk about that. Is there anyone in the room who would like to, and here too, well, of course, but who has templates for?
I'm just saying, we have a neighborhood project that we're trying to do. We picked the subject matter. People are interested in it because they think, oh, rain gardens.
Mm-hmm.
But to make that connection between climate change, health, it's been a struggle for us. So since this is about vulnerable populations, how do you have that conversation outside of the scientists and the MPH like us?
Yep, it's a great project. There is a way to get exactly to where you want to be. Anyone? I saw a hand back there on that seemed like you were speaking to her question.
I just wanted to say, but I'll wait to see if anyone wants to comment.
Go ahead.
I'm from Marshall State Flood Center. We've been working with groups on the Gulf Coast to look at sea level rise and how climate change would impact their communities. And actually, talking with community groups that are helping us implement our research and outreach programs, their recommendation from the local groups have actually been to not use the term climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And to find ways to talk about what would be happening locally on a personal level and a community level without using those words, because that makes people put up a wall, and in their community at least, this is an ongoing thing that goes. So to find other ways to talk about what would be happening in a more local and immediate sense. You know, you might have flooding in your backyard, or you might, your marsh might go away because of this, but not climate change is going to cause you to have flooding. So I think that's something you can learn from community groups who are on the ground, because they're much closer to the community and know what could be acceptable. So that might be just.
Can we connect you to after? Can you make it a point, and I'm happy to facilitate this, for this conversation to connect afterwards, because this is really important. And I would like to be able to join in that too.
Sure.
Are you speaking to Dr. Pepper or is it a fresh question?
Pepper. I work on air quality in Central Valley, in California. Just sort of a question for everybody. I mean, I think that's a very valid point of, people put up this wall and they, it's too big. But I guess a lot of you, many of you spoke to the future,
mm-hmm.
and more fires and, more deaths. And at some point it seemed like we need to, I don't know, be alarmist, but when we have blank, it's like we're sort of waiting for more and more worse stuff to happen. And I just wonder, how do we translate it into the neighborhoods? How do we get people to understand, when 5 more homes go, or when, 6 more people die of asthma, or it's almost like there needs to be something at which we say, we're going to do something. Otherwise, we sit around and we don't want to hear it. I mean, the community. So I don't know if any of you want to speak to that about making predictions and therefore writing policy. If we have, this, then we will do something. And
I see air quality as a big issue right now,
mm-hmm.
that needs to be addressed. And, granted, we predict things getting worse in certain areas going on to the future, but right now it needs to be addressed. And that's something that I think people can grasp onto and see. I mean, they can see the air pollution. I mean, we can see it here in the brown cloud. And it's visible, and it's something that you can target. And by targeting that, you can have co-benefits for the climate as well. I don't know, but I address things from an air quality perspective rather than a climate perspective.
And The local laws in New York City on moving to the low sulfur heating fuels and on the idling time reduction, those were about immediate health benefits today.
Yeah.
The climate change co-benefit is a, you know, that's a co, but it's about today's health. I mean, that's for the immediate, that's for today's population. So that's driven by an immediate air pollution sensibility and the fact that kids and people's health is being harmed today. There's a gentleman, sir, are you in the back standing for a question? No, okay, thank you. But there is a hand in the back.
I'd like to speak to this issue of how to talk about these things. And this probably comes from my professional perspective over the years, which is in bioethics in the University of Nebraska and many years. Our experience in talking about cancer, there were many, many years we didn't use the word. And it really wasn't until we used the word that we began to come to terms with care for dying. I don't think anyone ever said we should never say AIDS or HIV. Now that we can talk about people being gay, homosexual, so on, and the rest of the letters, I think things are going better, although there's a lot of challenges and difficulty. And I think there's a Gandhian point here, because the people who most want us not to say words like climate change are people in power. And so this is an issue of speaking truth to power. And I think wherever we're hiding from this, we're also hiding from things that need to be said. And so when you draw maps of the city that show blue areas and red areas, and the red are the vulnerable, in some way the blue areas are the real problems, because these are the people who are driving the problem, these are the big carbon dioxide emitters. These are the murderers. The people in the vulnerable area are the murderees. Of course, these are suicide murderers, because in the blue areas, because they're killing themselves as well in the long run. Now, that's way judgmental. We're only talking third degree. Third degree murder is negligence. It's not a deliberate murder. But the moral situation is made clear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that if we don't deal with the mitigation problem, we're not speaking to the problem, we're not being ethical, and whatever the power results or the political results are of speaking the truth, we ought to.
There's comments on that, but point of clarification, it seems like this woman, like your comment was that the people would be confused by the term climate change. But there were a number of points of
clarification.
True. It seems like there were a number of points in response to the gentleman's point. Yes, there were a number of hands from Lexi Schultz there and other people here. And why don't you continue, the respondents here to that question. But let me ask, did Dr. Hayden, did you have something you wanted to say to that?
No.
Okay, then continue.
I hear on a regular basis this comment about you can't say climate change if you're trying to affect change at the local level, and I think we have to be very sensitive to the local needs and the local individuals if you're trying to get change. If you see the walls go up, then you're not going to get change at the very local level. But I'm also interested in that translation of when and how, if you start to connect with people, how you can then start to connect that back ultimately to climate change, because we are facing a very, very challenging time at the national level trying to affect change. I don't think we're going to see large change in the next year, but if we don't defend the efforts that are taking place at the federal level and the Environmental Protection Agency, we're looking at the most severe consequences down the line, and things are only going to get worse. So it's just something that I'm asking people to think about is, even if you're facing those barriers, how do we then start to pivot that back thinking about what the real change is
going to
be down the line.
Yeah. You know, I'm torn because there were at time, but this is such a provocative and important question. I guess in the interest of being sort of true to the session, I should call time, but can we continue out in the hallway? Because there's not anything that's more important than the fact that air pollution is going to be challenged by what's happening. Can I just say to everyone who asked a question and has their hand raised and who was here, and to the panel, thank you so much for being here and participating. Thank you very much.